Coming up on Boston Public Radio, our political panel is former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Shannon O'Brien and Globe State House Bureau Chief Frank Phillips. We'll talk Paul Cellucci's legacy and Markey versus Gomez with just 15 days to go. And then Edward Snowden leaked information on the American government's massive surveillance of its own people. Is he a hero or a traitor?
Open mic with Gene Rivers is at 1 o'clock. He'll talk about the opening of the Trayvon Martin trial. Then more and more of us are banning cell phones from private celebrations. And Jared Bowen joins us for the best and worst of last night's Tony Awards. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So here to discuss the legacy of Governor Paul Cellucci, who, as you know, died of ALS Saturday afternoon, Gomez Markey with, what, 15 days to go, and when they've been quite drunk, like the governor was after the Jahar Tsarnaev, right? Dying to hear that. Former treasurer of the Commonwealth. She's also a former Democratic candidate for governor, Shannon O'Brien. Shannon, good to see you.
Hello.
And we will be joined in a couple of minutes. He's running late, stuck in traffic or something. The longtime State House Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. That would be Frank Phillips.
Hi, Shannon O'Brien.
Hi.
So give us your best Paul Cellucci story.
My best Paul Cellucci story was there was one of a number of tax rollback questions that have been on the ballot, which is how I met Mr. Brody. I don't even want to mention how many years ago.
It was a while ago.
A long time ago. And I remember debating Paul Cellucci, and he was a tough debater. And I just remember.
Wait, was this in 90? Or you mean the
no,
one in 2000?
No, 2000. It was
2000. When he was governor and you were treasurer,
yes.
You debated him?
Yeah, I debated him in 2000.
Because it was
yeah.
on the ballot. I remember yeah. this. He couldn't get the tax rollback through the Democratic
yeah.
legislature. And you're a Democrat. He was a Republican. And he took it to the ballot.
And I remember, and again, this is probably through my prism as a woman running for office and having been characterized as being, you know, really mean and a tough. I mean, I think I sort of, you know, when I was running for governor, I sort of said, well, maybe Mitt Romney's not telling the truth, you know, maybe. And I was, you know, portrayed as being mean and tough. He would scream at people. He was one tough guy.
We're talking about Paul Cellucci?
Paul, he was tough. He was a tough debater. He was a very good debater, you know. So
what was he like? I mean, you served as a constitutional officer at the same time he did. Apart from the issues, mm-hmm. apart from, like, tax cutting, where he had a pretty strong position, and obviously you had a strong position 180 degrees away, what was he like as a human to deal with when he was governor?
You know, he was fairly partisan, although he was a pretty liberal legislator. I was in the House when he was first in the Senate, I believe,
yeah.
and we didn't overlap in the same chamber. But the word that you heard from a lot of people is decent. You know, I think that was really what Paul was about. He was a very decent guy, you know, very, very partisan, but someone who wasn't nasty in his approach to his fellow legislative colleagues, and someone that you could have a conversation with. And I think that was probably what you're going to see or hear from other Democrats who've worked with him, is that he was a consummate legislator, which is ultimately when Bill Weld chose him to be, you know, his running mate. He chose a guy who was sort of the consummate insider, inside the State House guy, who had good relationships with people. Bill was the sort of, you know, kind of goofy, outside-of-the-box thinker, outside-of-the-State House candidate with a lot of money to spend. And Paul was the perfect balance for him, and they ended up obviously becoming quite close friends.
And for those who weren't around at that time, the phrase that was coined, I don't know if you know who first said it. Maybe Frank Phillips, when he gets here. Welducci was the term, as they were literally joined at the hip.
For some reason, I think it was Dan Bosley who said
that.
I don't
true?
Know why.
Former state rep.
I think
yeah.
it might have been Dan Bosley. I don't know why that comes into my head. But
well,
anyway.
For people that do not know, Paul Cellucci did have a long career in the legislature before he became
and a selectman for a number
right.
of years.
That's right. He was a selectman up there in Hudson, mm-hmm. where he lived his whole life. Much has been made of that because he continued that small town
presence,
commuting
like
back and forth into Boston, and people said that enabled him not to lose touch with the guy at the gas station in Hudson, and then the little convenience store in Hudson. He served 8 years as a state rep, 6 years as a state senator, then combined with, of course, he ran briefly against Weld, and then he decided to join up with Weld, the Welducci candidacy. Mm-hmm. But you know what I remember about Paul Cellucci, too, as the governor, is he was underestimated. I mean, I think a lot of people thought, including myself, that when he ran in the primary against Joe Malone, people may recall Joe Malone ran against Ted Kennedy and was hailed as a bright young star because of the classy way Joe Malone conducted the race with Ted Kennedy. I think lots of people thought Joe Malone, very charming guy, was going to beat Paul Cellucci when he ran in the primary against him. Paul Cellucci prevailed. And then Paul Cellucci ran against Scott Harshbarger, very popular attorney general, former Middlesex County DA, you know, Harvard guy, good-looking guy, and Cellucci beat Harshbarger as well. I mean, I think we clearly underestimated his ability to get votes in Massachusetts.
He was someone who plugged along for a lot of years and was liked, was well-liked. And I think that also he, you've seen a lot of Republican candidates kind of, come out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Whether they were someone like Weld who, did have a sort of political or public service background. But, you see people that kind of came out of nowhere. Paul basically moved from place to place, making his contribution, kind of built up from selectman in Hudson to state representative to state senator to lieutenant governor to ultimately winning, as you pointed out, a very tough not only Republican primary, which, by the way, tough Republican primaries. You don't hear that phrase used that
very
often.
Tough.
But they don't often have really tough Republican primaries.
And so, there are no Republicans.
But again, they tend to be a smaller group and more self-anointed, if you will. And then to become an ambassador, that was his crowning achievement.
Well, I have to say, I'm not sure I get the whole ambassador thing. I understand Bill Weld leaving in his hope that he'd be ambassador to Mexico, which he never obviously achieved.
Right.
Thanks to Jesse. What's Jesse?
Jesse Helms.
Jesse Helms stopped him. But the thing that I never... Paul Cellucci was such a local guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he had a Bush connection, a pretty close connection with Bush the Elder. But I never understood why a guy who it seemed to me... I didn't know him that well. I knew him a little bit. Whose dream as a selectman in Hudson had to be to be governor of Massachusetts. Why do you leave that midterm? You have a weird smile on your face. You think just something? What is it?
I think that part of the reason that he left is that you basically had, and this is what happened when I was state treasurer. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you recall, but we helped, kind of blow the whistle on the cost overruns at the Big Dig, that they weren't telling the truth. And so you'd seen, and this was not Paul, this had kind of sort of predated Paul, really under Bill Weld, but this constant, growing of the Big Dig cost.
You think that's why he decided to leave?
I don't know if that's why he decided to leave, but I will tell you, I think that it would have been very, very hard to anybody from that sort of Welducci administration. The Big Dig was going to be hung around someone's neck, and it ended up, there was Jane Swift. And frankly, that was one of the things that made Mitt Romney a particularly tough candidate against me. He wasn't any part of that kind of Big Dig not telling the truth about the Big Dig, situation. So,
well, I want to talk about
it. I'm not sure if that's why, but I do know that running for re-election on that kind of a, on that kind of a platform was going to be a little bit difficult.
That's the voice of Shannon O'Brien, former state rep. She was the treasurer of Massachusetts in part during the time that Cellucci was governor, and she ran for governor against Mitt Romney in 2002. I want to talk about the Romney thing. It seems I am always amazed when a Republican in this state, where it's almost impossible to get elected statewide, does not run as a descendant of Welducci, of Weld and Cellucci. I'm amazed that they think they can get elected in this state. Mitt Romney, the gubernatorial candidate, Mitt Romney.
That
not
one?
Not the presidential
that
candidate.
One, I remember
he essentially
that one.
Did learn a ton of lessons. You would know this better than anybody from Weld and Cellucci. He did run as the fiscal conservative, semi-social liberal, a la Weld and Cellucci, no?
Oh, absolutely. When you hear Gabriel Gomez calling himself a new Republican, there's nothing new about this model. I mean, Frank Sargent, you think going back decades and decades, the model of Republicans in this state is fiscally conservative, more socially liberal. There's nothing new about that here in Massachusetts. And frankly, it's why you can attribute a lot of success to many Republican statewide candidates, because the Democratic legislature is so entrenched. I mean, they keep getting reelected. elected, and the numbers keep getting bigger and bigger, that Massachusetts, which is now primarily independent, wants that balance between the democratically controlled. The independents keep sending back their Democrats to the legislature, but they want that sort of moderate Republican at the helm to keep them in check.
But there are a couple of really out of the box things that Paul Cellucci did, which I'm embarrassed to say I was only reminded that he did when I was reading over the weekend about his accomplishments when he was the governor.
Great piece, by the way, by Bell English and Frank.
And Frank Phillips.
Frank is.
There is a great piece. Yeah, we hope Frank is going to be showing up.
He's
here
not under
this.
The table. No, he's not.
No,
here.
He's not under the table. But I thought Bill Weld pushed through what's called a dangerousness hearing. And if people don't know, when you go up for bail, previously it was, well, are you going to show up? Are you for bail? Do you have the money to pay the bail? You have flight risk? Do you have roots in the community, et cetera? And there was a lot of pushback from the victims' rights community saying, dangerous, very dangerous people should not be getting bail, and that should be a consideration. And it was Paul Cellucci who had to convince former Speaker Sal DeMasi,
who opposed it.
Who is a longtime defense attorney.
Yes, there's a very strong defense attorney bar up on Beacon Hill, and the defense attorneys didn't like this, of course. And Paul Cellucci was the one who pushed through and ultimately got the dangerousness hearing. And that is a very big deal, because now when defendants come, they don't use it enough for my money, but now when defendants come before the court and they've, you know, committed a violent crime or allegedly committed a violent crime, or they've allegedly raped somebody, or they've done these terrible things, that alone is a reason to hold them pending their trial or their next court appearance or whatever. That was Paul Cellucci.
But again, it goes back to the fact that he was a decent guy, that he could have a conversation with people in the legislature. I mean, again, that was the problem that I think that that Romney ended up having, is that he started to attack the legislature rather than working with the legislature. Weld had an extremely – I mean, Bill Weld appointed Bill Bulger as president of UMass. He had a very good relationship with a number of different legislators, and certainly, you know, Weld and Cellucci both had a very good relationship with the most powerful, you know, state senator at the time.
Now, we are joined finally,
by the
about
delinquent.
8 minutes too late.
That's right.
By the longtime, and I do mean longtime, State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Hello there, Frank Phillips. How are you?
It was a miscommunication.
Well, what was that exactly?
That's what they always
last
say.
Last time I was here was at 12:30 when we went on the air. What was that all about?
So it's Shannon, always the same, Frank Phillips. So you had a great piece about English, about Paul Cellucci over the weekend. And you've covered governors for a long time. So I wonder, in the pantheon of governors, you know, where do you see Paul Cellucci in terms of his accomplishments, in terms of his style?
I think he was greatly underestimated, and his influence was, because he was overshadowed by this colorful figure, Bill Weld, the boar hunter, the guy, the duck
the
shooter.
Pond jumper, river jumper.
The poker playing, amber drinking, you know, liquid, whatever he was drinking. And we all loved covering him, and he sort of was the public face of the administration. But you really, if you knew what was going on and you talk to people now, it was Paul Cellucci was the one that guided Bill Weld through that administration. He was in the Adirondacks while everybody else was working on the budget.
Weld was in the Adirondacks.
But how about
his governor? We talked with Shannon a couple of seconds ago. I totally got that Weld left. Primarily because he was bored, but he said it was because he wanted to be ambassador to Mexico. I was stunned that Paul Cellucci decided to leave for an ambassadorship.
Why would you be stunned?
Because he's a local kid. Dream was Shannon O'Brien's thesis. Can I put words in your mouth and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Shannon O'Brien? Is that, I know you're not going to like this, but you'll correct it. Is that part of what greased the way? Can I say that or not? Well, you say it yourself.
I just think that they had kind of come to the end of the line on the big dig. I think that was sort of building and building, and there wasn't any place else for them to go. But, I mean, I certainly agree with Frank. I mean, if someone wanted to appoint me ambassador to any place that we weren't necessarily going to go to war with or maybe get shot in,
that's you leave the governorship for it?
I wouldn't leave Midnight. I would not. That's the best job.
First week that Bill Weld became governor in 91, one of his top aides, John Moffitt, sat down to him and says, now you plan your exit strategy. Getting out, is one of the hardest things to do, getting out gracefully. He had the opportunity. His good friend George Bush and his best friend Andy Card were running the White House. And here he had a chance to go to Canada and be a U.S. ambassador. Couldn't be better. Set you up for life in terms of what you're going to do in the future. You have all
these
contacts.
I had heard,
contacts.
By the way, it wasn't in your piece, and your piece was great with Bell English. I had heard that he had been offered the executive directorship of the Worcester Chamber of Commerce. Do you have any idea of that?
we tracked that down. It wasn't true.
Where did the
I think you were spreading it around, though.
Where did the Well? We were asking Shannon. She thought it might have been former representative from Western Mass, Dan Bosley. Who coined the Welducci phrase, which I thought was perfect? Who did that? Do you know?
I think it was Bosley.
I haven't heard that in years.
Welducci. I think it might have been Bosley.
Bosley was good at that. Yeah. Bosley was good.
My favorite story. Yeah.
That was unusual to really be so close.
That was sort of like before Bennifer or anything like that. He sort of started that.
No, but by the way, that is not even...
We've never had a lieutenant governor with that kind of influence, and particularly with...
You don't think Tim Murray... I mean, develop... Now, I don't mean this is... The first one was a joke. This is not a joke. The respect that Deval Patrick has shown for Tim Murray for 6 years, even in the darkest of times for Tim, has been stunning to me. He's never missed an opportunity that I've seen, either here or elsewhere, to praise Murray and his role. I don't mean when he left, but I mean while he was here. That was a variation on a theme, even though Murray is not Deval Patrick.
Well, Murray, I think, did play a good role, had an important role with the administration, but he had not been at the State House for all those years, 16 years or whatever it was that Cellucci was there. Cellucci had the skills
and the relationships.
Can you tell the Grateful Dead story that I didn't remember? Was it the first time it was told? The Grateful Dead story from your piece with Bell English? Can you tell that story? Or you didn't write that piece?
I wrote that piece.
Okay, so I figured Bella may have written that piece. Tell the story about the flag at half staff in 1995.
Well, in his zaniest times, it was August, summer. He would probably wish he was up at the Adirondacks. Jerry Garcia dies, and he wants to lower the flag on from the State House.
Jerry Garcia was the leader of the Grateful Dead. If you missed that era. Go ahead.
Yeah, you missed that era.
And Frank is still having flashbacks from those years, so this is vivid for him.
And his staff was saying, no. Well said, no, we're going to do it. Well, Cellucci came into the office, and only Cellucci could do this to Well, and says, you are not doing that. And you know, a week before he died, I was with him for 2 hours out at his house.
Cellucci, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, tell us about that.
And He told me that story again, and he said, I went in there, and I said, you are not doing it. But just like that, Well just backed down
Tell us about that, though, because, I know he was – his body was pretty much paralyzed, but he was talking and could move his head and could carry on and joke and laugh.
My wife and I have been and this is – since he came back from Canada, we've gotten to know him, and particularly under the with the Lou Gehrig disease. So we've been over there to the house. They live in Hudson. We live in Concord. So it's not far. We go over. We've been over several times. We've been out to dinner earlier when he could do that and got to know his wife. And we went over and saw him. And increasingly he was, first he could go out to dinner and he's in a wheelchair. Now he was completely immobile from the head down. And you could see the breathing. His diaphragm obviously had gone at that point. I shouldn't talk too much details on this, but what was amazing was his spirit. It was incredible. And I sat there just as we always do, and we banter back and forth. I got you on this. You got me on that. I would bring up all these great stories, going back to when he was a state senator and running for governor and lieutenant governor and governor, and times he would yell and scream at me at governor. We'd laugh about it. And he was terrific. And I heard hospice and I heard that around, but it was like the 800-pound gorilla that I didn't see sitting there. And I walked out, and my wife turned to me and she said, Jan says he has 1 week to live. And I just broke down. I just broke down now. I look over at Jim, I feel better now. I gained my manhood.
You would know that because of the breathing. It was increasingly difficult to breathe.
I was having fun. I was having such fun, and he was so alive.
So where did that come from, that spirit, you think? People have mentioned over and over again there was no self-pity and acceptance of the disease.
It was absolutely extraordinary. I don't know. That was an extraordinary experience, watching him go through what he was going through. And Because I couldn't imagine. None of us could.
I can't. Can I tell, given all of his political success, which ranged from the absolutely local town selectman to international affairs, I think that his greatest legacy is what he demonstrated while he was sick with ALS.
And raised a ton of money.
I mean, he called me personally. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I mean, we were talking earlier. My story was, you know, me like him screaming at me, you know, on a tax rollback debate and, you know, going back and forth. But he picked up the phone. He called me. He spoke to my husband, Emmett. You know, he had when they did that fundraiser for the UMass Medical Center, there were as many Democrats in the room as there were Republicans in the room.
Fundraising in 98 was his biggest asset. He went every night out raising huge amounts of money. That was one of the reasons he beat Joe Malone.
Yeah.
And he went on to beat Hochberger.
We should also,
which was pretty incredible when you think about it, because I think a lot of people thought that Joe Malone was going to clean his clock.
I compared it. He was the Truman in this administration. Truman followed this charismatic, upper class guy everybody loved, Roosevelt, and and all the things that were hated about Truman, about Roosevelt, got dumped on Truman, and he never got appreciated for what he was until David McCullough wrote his book just about, but he never got appreciated. Same thing with Salucci. People did not understand that he did a lot of things. We maybe didn't agree with him, and Shannon would, as a Democrat, could articulate that. But there was a lot of things he accomplished a great deal, and he got it through. And he took those skills to Canada. Well, that's one of the things that was extraordinary is that when he went to Canada, he just wasn't a wallflower, a fundraiser that got a nice position. 9/11 happened. He had to negotiate and deliver messages to the Canadian government all the time. And he knew and his
Which was then liberal run. During a time of war, which was not very popular in Canada.
That's what Andy Carr, I talked to Andy Carr the day before Paul died, and he said he delivered our messages, and they were tough messages.
Yeah.
And it was a tough back and forth. And he brought back.
You mean
those
tough
messages.
About people coming over the border, or what? Are
no,
you talking
no,
about?
No. Just get in line with us.
Oh, okay.
We need you.
Okay.
The coalition.
We have to be hand in glove with Canada.
Yeah.
And we're still too. People forget that they're not part of the United States sometimes.
And only somebody who's been a political leader knew how to message. You know, this is so important. How to message what they were trying to the agenda, the Bush agenda up there, which, you know, we all might have disagreements with. But he did it and he carried it. And then after 9/11, there were all these complicated things about the moving of people and commerce across the border. And, you know, everything was shut down. How do you do that? It was a tough task.
You know, on a much lighter note, Paul Salucci was famous for playing the ponies. He loved to gamble. Did he keep that up?
I don't know. I didn't dare ask him because last time I asked was during
the
racing, 98
didn't
campaign. He was furious at me because it was connected with
he didn't called, he have the racing thing? What do you call it?
The racing form.
Didn't he carry that around the State House with him?
No.
I'm sorry.
We should also mention that Margaret Marshall was appointed. I mean, in terms of historic moments.
By him.
Margaret Marshall was appointed Chief Justice, and everybody knows what she's famous for and what made Massachusetts famous
and
for.
And I talked to him right afterwards. He said, that's not what I wanted her to do. Last Saturday, he very proudly said, I signed that amicus brief for gay marriage.
Really? Yeah, so he changed his mind about that. And he
changed his mind about a few things, which I don't think he wants me to tell him.
I bet he changed his mind about the death penalty. I bet he did.
He was a lot more liberal before he ran with Weld, though, Frank. I mean, that's also one of those things. Yeah. Is that? And I was thinking about this, you know, in coming to the show today. He was much more liberal when he was, a backbench state representative, you know. And then, you know, remember, he and Weld ran in 1990. This is after, you know, Michael Dukakis had lost for president. This is when the Reagan, you know, sort of new wave of Republican conservatism was happening. They became much more conservative, I think, than Paul truly was. I mean, even when we were talking about that debate, I remember once I said to my husband, I came out of this debate with him, and he's like yelling and going, I mean, he's a good debater, but killing me. And I remember wanting to say to him, are you really inside there? Is that you? Because I always believed that he was a much more progressive soul than a lot of his policy. And you know what? When you have a legislature that at that point in time was 80 to 85%, 85% Democratic, you can kind of let them get to where you want to be, and you can take the posture that
you want. I love driving him nuts in those press scrums where he would go after somebody for flip-flopping. I said, you mean like on the death penalty? And he would, and we always laughed. We laughed about that.
Because he had a record.
We laughed
Will
about
didn't.
That a week ago.
Yeah.
We were laughing about that. And I remember him coming out when he just lost Slattery on the death penalty. And
you should give for those who don't know, the death penalty carried by one vote, if I recall, under
John Slattery.
Then John Slattery was called in by then Speaker Tom Finneran, correct? And then he had an epiphany. Slattery flipped his vote, and then
and
death penalty
also,
failed by one vote.
We should
right?
also point out that the big push came after Jeffrey Curley, that you know his dad from Cambridge, a 10-year-old boy who was murdered, and people were outraged, as well they should be, and that brought about a big push for the death penalty.
And when there was when that flip occurred, he came out of the office, and he was furious. He was going to the elevator, and we were around him, and he said, there's been chicanery going on here, chicanery. I said, what's chicanery? Where is it? I know there's chicanery. Where is it? And he says, there is chicanery. He got in the elevator, and I looked at him. He winked at me. Down he went.
Last
week, when there were some changes in his opinions, I said, there's been some chicanery going on in this house.
Remember? That's pretty good.
Oh, we always use that word as a code word about chicanery.
That's the voice of Frank Phillips, who's head of the State House Bureau for the Boston Globe. Shannon O'Brien is the other voice. She's a former state treasurer of Massachusetts, ran for governor against Mitt Romney in 2002. I feel almost ridiculous after discussing Paul Zalucci to talk politics, but we got to do it.
Before, what's
that?
Just real one quick.
Sure.
Because it seems to me it was a real love story. He married his high school sweetheart.
I'm glad you. I was just saying. Yeah. I want to talk. Jan was just absolutely terrific. She's I never knew her. I probably beat up on her because she got special jobs. I thought she was getting special jobs.
Yeah, that
somewhere.
Was your fault. You beat up on her.
I did probably, but she was so sweet. Sweet to me, which I was surprised. But also, just so she
lovely
to his, and she helped him on his. Come around on some political views.
Yeah, and she also quit her job to take care of him in her last years. And not to mention a superficial note.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, Paul Zalucci looked like Robert De Niro, very handsome guy, even in his last week. She saw the picture of him just a couple of months ago in his wheelchair, and he looked great.
She always brought him down. When he said, I married my childhood sweetheart, my high school sweetheart, and she always piped up, and she did that the last day. She said, one of them. I was one of them.
That's a great line.
She always kept them honest. She really
okay.
did.
Okay, Gomez versus Markey, 15 days to go. How would you characterize the state of the race, Shannon O'Brien?
I would characterize the state of the race. I mean, I think that Ed Markey, I watched the last debate, and I think he did a much better job. I think he needed to do a much better job debating. I think that the numbers are looking a lot better for him. I don't think this is going to be a walk, and I think that they're going to have the infrastructure on the Democratic Party to be able to win this race. And my sense is it's probably a 10 to 15-point race.
Now, what are you allowed to say about this as an intrepid,
I'm supposed to be a little more objective,
unbiased reporter?
I think Gomez had his chance at that debate, and he really flubbed it. He had a chance to be senatorial, show us what he could do as a U.S. senator, and he came out, you know, sort of wagging his finger sort of in a nasty way right off the bat.
That thing about you've been in Washington 37 years,
welcome back to Massachusetts. Yeah. It was not a way to introduce yourself. Now, how many people watch that debate? But I think also I've been very critical of, sort of implying, and we all have in our copy, that Ed Markey's not a very good candidate. And I've seen him out on the trail, and he's awkward, he's shy, he doesn't know how to deal with the press. After all these years, he's never had the Boston press on him. He's always, you know, walked through re-elections without any contest. And and his debates with Lynch were terrible. I mean, he had that haircut that he still had. I think it was the same one when McGee put him out in the out in the hallway. In the 70s.
I think his hair looks very nice now.
Thank you,
I think
Shannon.
He changed.
Marjorie and I discussed that at some length, I should say, during the primary season. But you know, it's
but I think he I think he rose the occasion. Looked like he wanted to be there.
Yeah.
Smiled and handled Gomez in a way that. And on a couple of
issues.
I thought
he did a very good job.
He did a very good job, and I was surprised, and I think that was the upskill.
We're talking with Frank Phillips from the Boston Globe, and Shannon O'Brien, who was the former treasurer of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I wonder, a lot of the polls have shown a big gender gap here in the Gomez-Markey race. Women are much more with Markey, men with Gomez. So is that all about choice, or what's that about, do you think? Just women vote for Democrats, generally speaking, in Massachusetts?
I mean, Gomez is a pretty handsome guy, and I hate to say this. I've met more than enough women who voted for Mitt Romney against me because he was so good-looking.
Right.
You know what I mean? But the fact is, I think that he does not even know what his position is on choice.
Shannon's
and
wondering if Marjorie Regan was one of them, by the way. She's not going to answer the question.
Oh, I wasn't asking that question.
I did not vote for Mitt Romney.
I'm kidding.
No, but the problem is, you know, he's got Eric Fernstrom, Mitt Romney's, you know, former, you know, political consultant, and I think he's memorized enough of the lines. The problem is, when you're first running, I think this has also been a problem for Markey because he hasn't been in front of the Boston press scrum. And I can tell you, huge difference, even having run for treasurer, you know, yeah, right, we're covering the race. When you go from running for treasurer to governor or senator, the intensity is so much different. So I think that Gomez on paper is a great candidate. He's taken a lot of the so-called new Republican issues, but he really doesn't know his own positions. And so he keeps saying things that he thinks he remembers. I mean, that long pause in the debate, he was trying to remember, how do I make all this work out? He really does not understand.
On the 24-hour waiting period.
On the Supreme Court, would you or would you not support a Supreme Court justice who would overturn Roe v. Wade? And he's parroting the Mitt Romney line, which is, I will change no laws. And the fact is, then 5 minutes after Mitt Romney got elected governor, then all of a sudden he was talking about changing laws on abortion.
Can we stay on choice for a second? Yeah. It seems to me, is it possible that a candidate in 2013 or in the near future can win a statewide race in Massachusetts and not be pro-choice?
I don't care
who you are. It seems to me that that is such a critical element of a winning candidacy. Who has won a major election who, even if they say, I mean, in many ways, in fact, we said this, Ted Markey, when he was on with us a couple of weeks ago, isn't Gabriel Gomez essentially Ted Kennedy, Mario Cuomo, personally pro-life, but would never have government interfere.
Not really, and Markey, Ed King, right?
And Markey said, yeah. I thought quite why. Markey said, yeah, but the devil's in the details. The Blunt Amendment, the Stupak Amendment.
Right.
And that, so you can't
there
win.
There are
this
details,
state.
There are details, and there are greater threats now in terms of the balance of power in the Supreme Court, and people are concerned. And the fact that he came out and said that he would support literally changing the balance of power, because it was always, oh, it's not my decision to make. The Supreme Court has spoken. Roe v. Wade is law of the land, and this guy comes up and said, I'd be willing to change. I'm not changing the laws, but he doesn't even comprehend that Roe v. Wade, that a court decision is the law. He doesn't even get that. That's
scary. Well, I'm not sure if he doesn't get that. I think it's the amendments. But, Frank, you know, the other thing I am stunned about, and I'm waiting for the piece to come out on the front page of the Globe, too. And this is self-serving, because I've asked Gomez about this a lot.
Girls end up in NECN soon.
I'll probably be there first. The last 9 years of Gomez's life, he was this private equity firm. He won't answer any questions about it. He won't say who his clients were, any of this sort of stuff. Why are you laughing at me?
Because the Democrats have put you up, and I have to watch you through yes, all those sequences of you. You were here last time. Do you remember?
Good question.
This is
don't
all,
you think?
This is
good
your
questioning
thing.
By me or no?
Yeah,
yes
was,
or no?
It was okay.
Okay, fine. So the question is, if a guy spends 9 years of his life before he runs for office doing a certain thing, how is it we're not reading about, how is it there are not demands made to say, open the books, be transparent?
Oh, my God, we're not following up on your
No, I'm serious.
Question.
Do you think it's an important issue? Do you not
yes,
think
I do think it's an important issue. I don't mean to demean it. We've asked it. What can you do? You can write it so many times. I mean, we are taking a look. We have some of our reporters taking a very hard look at his background in private equity, and I think you'll see some things written about it.
You know the election's in 15 days. I just want to be sure you know that, right?
Oh, it is.
Exactly.
When he said that earlier, I almost fell over.
It is 15 days.
I know. I mean, I know when the date is, but I forget.
Well, you know, speaking of that, a little bit of history, particularly from you, before we leave this subject.
Because I'm old.
Can you think? No, you've been around for a number of Senate races. Well, everybody in this room has been.
Long time.
Can you think of a Senate race, even a special United States Senate race, that had a profile as low as this one?
We've only had one special election
or regular Senate race. You know, and I don't want to hear anymore, not from you, from anybody.
Sure.
We have election fatigue, whatever that garbage is. But it seems this is so back-burnered. It's ridiculous.
John Kerry against that guy from Belmont.
We actually did the only radio and TV debates in that race. Beatty was his name.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
forgotten
that. Yeah, he's now a consultant at CNN on terrorism or something. He's on CNN all the time. Yeah, he is. Jeff Beatty.
And then there was a guy who ran against Kennedy in 2000. You know, well, Jack Robinson tried to do it.
We love Jack Robinson.
Oh, he was on there. No, it was Jack Robinson.
Jack E. Robinson. Okay, so maybe I was right.
Yeah, yeah.
Last question.
You want me to keep going?
Both of you.
You want to go about Mike Robinson in 1976 against Kennedy? Huh? Where do you want me to go?
We had a personal question to end this thing. We read the other day, as I'm sure you saw, Hank, at your former workplace, the Boston Herald, that the governor told a business group that he was, quote, quite drunk in Western Massachusetts after the capture of Jawahar Tsarnaev. We want to know, what was the public event that caused you to get quite drunk the night after, Frank?
The night after?
Yeah.
Can I tell a Paul Salucci story?
Sure you can. Yes.
Perfect.
My wife and I were going to this is just after he announces he's going to Canada and before he leaves office. And we had gone to Landmark Theaters in Waltham, just the two of us, one Saturday night to see if some English film, one of those things.
Of course.
La-di-da.
So who shows up out of, from
– who's a huge film guy. We didn't mention
this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought he was into, you know Bruce Willis stuff, you know. He showed up at this English film with his buddies from another couple and his wife, and they're sitting there, and he gets up to leave, and I go out to get some popcorn. I come back, and I've been writing some tough stuff about Jane Swift, and all remember her stuff at Suffolk University and other stuff about
his lieutenant governor, for those who don't
remember. Who's going to take over. And I was just at that point writing some stuff about it, and he caught me right in the hallway outside as people were coming in and going, and he had a leather jacket on, and he's got that De Niro look with the dark thing, and he pushes me up against the wall, and he's poking his finger at me, using four-letter words, yelling,
this.
"You stop that, bah, 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 bah," he's yelling, and I'm up against the wall like this, and I've seen people go by, and they all seem to look at the governor of the Commonwealth. I have this guy up against the wall.
See, now, the problem is there are no smartphones to get that picture, because I could make money selling that picture, Frank.
So I'm laughing
at him, and he's really yelling at me. And I finally said, "You don't care about Jane Swift. What you want is everybody to be comfortable with her taking over, and they're not going to get in the way of your combination. You know it." And he looks at me, he says, "You're right."
that's
great. But I was shaken. I was a little shaken.
I don't blame you.
So I didn't go out and get drunk.
Do you want, I don't know what the question was nor the answer. On that note,
a stupid question.
We'll let you go. Thank you very much. So you'll follow up on that Advent International thing with Gomez,
I'll let
Frank?
You know. I'll
thank
let you know.
Frank Phillips and Shannon O'Brien, thanks so much, both of you guys.
Thank you very much. Okay, up next, we're going to look at the actions of Edward Snowden. He's the former CIA employee who leaked NSA surveillance activity to the press. Ask you guys, is he a hero or a traitor? That conversation next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
The Better Business Bureau warns of a shell game making its way around the country, with letters hitting mailboxes throughout Rhode Island and Massachusetts in recent months.
What this business is doing is merging two great names together to instill trust, and people like my parents fall victim to this every day.
I'm senior reporter Philip Martin, spotting an old letter scam that could be coming to your mailbox soon. This afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And EBSCOhost Informing the World. EBSCO's technical managers and software engineers use emerging technologies to return results for over 100 million search requests per day. Over 40 open technology positions at EBSCOhost.com. And Inspector George Gently. Martin Shaw stars as the inspector whose brutal honesty makes him feared by criminals and colleagues alike. Don't miss Inspector George Gently, Monday at 9 on WGBH 44.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. Last week, we learned of the U.S. government's massive surveillance program. And then Sunday, we learned about the leaker himself, Edward Snowden. Here he is. Here's Snowden on deciding to become a whistleblower.
You recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem, until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
So, is Snowden a hero or is he a traitor? Is he headed for jail? Should he be? Did he threaten national security? Here to answer these questions, among others, is Noah Feldman. He's the Bemis Professor of Law at Harvard University. His latest book is Cool War, The Future of Global Competition. Noah Feldman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Professor, you know, obviously, that the Obama administration is saying that this guy Snowden really threatened national security. What do you think? Did he really?
You know, the extent to which he's a hero actually depends on the extent to which he actually betrayed real secrets. I think if you piece together carefully from news coverage over the last couple of years, you could have concluded, and indeed I myself had concluded in print and elsewhere, that probably every single phone call that originated in the United States or came into the United States was being gathered, and possibly on Earth, was being gathered by the NSA and evaluated not for its content, but for who initiated it. So to that extent, it wasn't radically new news that Snowden revealed. On the other hand, what we didn't have was an official document that definitively confirmed this. And as a result, we always talked about it as alleged, likely, probable. And that is precisely what Snowden disclosed. And so to that extent, he put the public debate about the topic on a very different footing, because it sounds different if you say, well, this is happening and here's the proof, than it does if you say, well, if you look at all the circumstantial evidence, this is probably what's happening. So, you know, I think he did generate real public debate that wasn't there previously. I think what he revealed, at least what we know of what he revealed so far, was something that could have been reconstructed and was probably known by any bad guys out there, but wasn't definitively confirmed.
But even if it turns out he did advance the knowledge or expand the knowledge of the bad guys, for lack of a better expression, what is it in what he leaked to both The Guardian and then subsequently to The Washington Post that in any way would harm our ability to defend ourselves against any threat? That's what I never quite got here, Professor.
I think there are two pieces. One is we haven't necessarily seen, and there have been some news reports that suggest that we haven't seen definitively significant parts of what he downloaded. One report that I saw, and again, this is all in the realm of speculation, said that he had taken 44 PowerPoint slides, of which only three had been ultimately publicized by the news sources, suggesting that there is material that he took that we ourselves still don't know. And so we can't speak about that. We don't know whether that information was potentially dangerous. With respect to the Verizon document, which has been at the center of so much discussion, I think, you know, you really have to press the envelope to say that national security was significantly harmed by that particular document, because, again, that's just the document that ordered Verizon to disclose the metadata, you know, the information of initiation and time for all calls. It's hard to see how that would definitively challenge national security. I suspect that the Obama administration, though, wants to say something more. They want to say that it threatens national security for there to be individuals who are sworn by oath and bound by law to keep secrets, who think that on their own they can go out there and reveal the secrets of the United States. I think that's the part where they see it as a fundamental threat to national security. And after all, he did violate, there's no question about this, he did violate explicit federal statutes that prohibit this action.
Well, I know they're not a perfect parallel, but couldn't almost everything that you say the Obama administration has said about Snowden, even before he was identified, have been said decades ago about Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers?
The parallel is an interesting one because, on the one hand, Ellsberg, like Snowden, explicitly broke the law. The documents, the Pentagon Papers that he disclosed, were themselves classified. Unlike Snowden, Ellsberg turned himself in for prosecution. And as it turned out, the only reason he didn't go to jail is that because the Nixon administration was so concerned and paranoid about discrediting Ellsberg that they ordered a break-in into his psychiatrist's office to check his records, and in other ways so tainted, they wiretapped him, and in other ways so tainted the possibility of a fair trial that he never ended up being charged. The other thing which might be a slight difference is that the Pentagon Papers that Ellsberg revealed were a historical document. They were a record that the Pentagon had itself created of the history of the war in Vietnam. And although it was very devastating to our attempts to continue the war, and it was politically significant for that reason, because it showed not only that we'd done badly, but that we knew we'd done badly over the years, it did not disclose, the Pentagon Papers did not disclose ongoing intelligence at the moment. And so arguably, from that perspective, although Snowden's revelations are much more general thus far, arguably what Snowden did was worse than what Ellsberg did. I should add that that's not what Ellsberg thinks. I mean, Ellsberg wrote an op-ed the other day making it very clear, indeed, that in his view, Snowden is the hero.
Yeah, we're talking with Noah Feldman. He's a professor of law at Harvard University about the case of this 29-year-old former CIA employer, Snowden, who revealed what was going on with Verizon and the NSA and collecting records of people's phones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what do you think? I mean, this Snowden guy is now he's in Hong Kong. He's talking about getting political asylum and going off to Iceland. He faces life in prison. What do you think should happen to him? Professor?
You know, my view is that there are people who, driven by conscience, knowingly break the law to serve the greater good, and that the right stance, if you've done that, is to acknowledge your wrongdoing and turn yourself in. And if you do that, I think you have to be prepared to accept the legal consequences of your actions. That's the classic model for civil disobedience. If I think the law is wrong or the law is unjust, as applied to me, I turn myself in, I make my argument to the court, and I accept that I'm probably going to be punished. I think being a whistleblower and then running is less of a morally admirable position. That said, I think it's very important to distinguish the whistleblower himself in this case from the news consuming public, and also the media that publishes what he says, because they, I think, should be very strongly protected by free speech rights and by the First Amendment. And so Glenn Greenwald, for example, who's the blogger and reporter
right. For
The Guardian,
information.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I think provided there isn't some revelation that he personally elicited this information, I think that he should be protected by the First Amendment and should not be in any way prosecuted for this, because I think it is important to preserve the freedom of the media.
You know, the initial accounts, Professor, were that Snowden left the country to avoid prosecution. But then what we've heard in the last 24 hours, and I know you have expertise in international law, so hopefully you can clarify this, is that we have an extradition treaty with Hong Kong. And if that's the case, why would he have chosen Hong Kong as a place, at least as his first stop outside the United States? I don't get that at all.
Yeah, I've been puzzling that over myself. Obviously, the possibilities are, first of all, that that's not why he chose Hong Kong. Second, he may have mistakenly thought that Hong Kong was, legally speaking, part of China, and we don't have an extradition treaty with China. In fact, Hong Kong has its own independent treaty-making capacity left over from the days when it was a British colony. And so even though Hong Kong is de facto part of China, it has its own legal relationship with us. I'd hate to think that he sought asylum there on the basis of some misreading of the internet. You know?
Oh, no.
I hate to put in a plug for lawyers because we come in for all kinds of grief, but if you intend to flee the country, it's probably a good idea to get official legal opinion on where you'll be, where you'd be safe and where you wouldn't be. We don't know yet. We don't know enough about the facts.
Let me tell you what he says, at least. He was asked in the most recent interview he did with The Guardian, why Hong Kong was the question. Here's at least what he says. I think it's really tragic that an American has to move to a place that has a reputation for less freedom. Still, Hong Kong has a reputation for freedom in spite of the People's Republic of China. It has a strong tradition of free speech. Again, I don't know where that leads him, but those were his words.
You know,
yeah, I'm not also completely sure that that's a fair description of what's going on in Hong Kong. Look, there are countries from Bhutan to Vanuatu that we don't have extradition treaties with, and most of them, frankly, are not the most pleasant places in the whole wide world, which they may not be places where you'd want to spend time. But if you really wanted to avoid extradition, those would be the countries where you'd want to go, and also, frankly, where your dollars would last a little bit longer than they would in Hong Kong, which is pretty expensive.
Professor, one last question from me. How does this differ? The Bradley Manning, of course, the Army private who released all that information, is archived to WikiLeaks. He's facing court-martial. I think it resumes today. How does this differ from the Manning case and WikiLeaks, the Snowden case?
Yeah, another really fascinating question. So first of all, I would say that in the WikiLeaks case, vast amounts of material were disclosed that were directly threatening and in some cases directly endangering to U.S. intelligence assets all over the world, and especially in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. The scope was just enormous, hundreds of thousands of documents. And although newspapers like the New York Times, in their version, went through and tried to sort out the stuff that might immediately injure people, WikiLeaks did not. And so the danger to individuals was much more substantial. On the other hand, the benefit to the public of knowing is, I think, arguably greater in this case, in the Snowden case, because these are facts that are relevant to every American. And the sort of revelation of WikiLeaks was basically that, you know, here are secrets that the United States government has been saying to itself. But there was nothing radically earth-shaking there that affected our individual liberties. And in this case, it does affect individual liberties. But the last thing that I would just say, and this is a bit odd, is that in both cases, you have the profile of an individual who doesn't particularly fit into the institution where he's found. And in Bradley Manning's case, you had to ask yourself, why in the world did he have access to such an extraordinary amount of information? And the answer turned out to be an ironic one, which was that the U.S. government was trying to do a better job of getting the Defense Department and the State Department to talk to each other, and so made access available to State Department cables. And remember, that's what the WikiLeaks cables largely were, to even relatively low-level military functionaries. In this case, you're talking about somebody who had worked for the CIA and was now a contractor working for the NSA. And that's a person who fits much more squarely into the model of who is supposed to have access to this information. And there you have to say, if it's such a deep secret, if these secrets are so deep, why wasn't a better job done of, you know, keeping an eye on him and on his colleagues? One has the sense that it was actually quite routinized, the use of this information. And again, that supports the theory that there wasn't a very fundamental breach of national security here.
Noah Feldman, thanks so much for your time. You really helped us out. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we want to ask you guys at 877-301-8970, what do you think about this Mr. Snowden, who's 29 years old, as we said before, released all this information, Edward Snowden, I should say, released all this information about the NSA snooping at Verizon phone records and the big controversy with the Obama administration last week. He said, Snowden said, that he thought there should be a public debate about this. Barack Obama has said that he thought things there should be a public debate about this. Alas, you couldn't be having a public debate because most of us didn't even know it was happening.
Had Snowden not broken the law?
Exactly. I mean, Professor Feldman said that if you were an expert like he is on these things, you might have been able to piece together the information and say, yes, this is happening, but I didn't know it was happening. So what do you think, hero or traitor? 877-301-8970. I don't want to go to jail for life, I'll tell you that.
Did you read the interview? Why did you become a whistleblower? If he says the NSA has built, this is Snowden, an infrastructure that allows it to intercept almost everything. With this capability, the vast majority of human communications are automatically ingested without targeting. If I wanted to see your emails or your wife's phone, all I have to do is use intercepts. I can get your emails, your passwords, your phone records, your credit cards. He says, I don't want to live in a society that does these sort of things. The only problem I have with this, and it's easy for me to say in light of the fact that I'm not being threatened with life in jail, I have to say, I'm paraphrasing what Professor Feldman said a minute ago, the moral something of Snowden's position, I think, is somewhat compromised, that he ran in an attempt to escape prosecution. If you believe in civil disobedience, if you believe you have to break laws because of a greater good, as I assume Snowden would say he was, then stay here and face the music. 877-301-8970. Well, then don't do it, I guess, is the bottom line. And that's why, and I thought the point that Feldman just said to us was great. Daniel Ellsberg turned himself in. This guy
was he facing life in prison, though? I don't know.
I don't know what it Well, he faced serious prosecution.
I think it's different when you're facing life in prison.
877-301-8970. Is he a hero or is he a traitor? And the point you make is so great, is that Obama, the president, says we should have this debate.
As they
but
are.
But we'd be having no debate.
Exactly.
Were it not for this guy breaking the law. And as a result of him breaking the law, talk about the oddness of the circle. He's being prosecuted and could face, will be prosecuted, and could face life in prison.
And as we learned, ironically, because Great Britain is much tougher on the press and freedom of the press than we are in the United States, Great Britain has been having this debate quite publicly. And we're not here in the United States of America, supposedly, where we have this great freedom to debate these things. Brian in the car, you are first on the hero or traitor question. What do you think, Brian?
I definitely don't think he's a hero. I agree with the professor that he should be accountable for his actions and step forward and accept responsibility for what he's done. But My question is sort of taking a step back and looking at what the government is actually collecting. It seems like they're collecting data. They're really just aggregating data that Verizon and AT&T and Facebook and all the other companies are already collecting on us. So the data, you know, it's not an invasion of our privacy. If anything, it's an invasion or a collection of data that's already been collected. So I'm not sure that any law's been broken.
First of all, but wait, law's been broken by whom? By the federal government?
That's my point.
Well, the federal government's position is they have an absolute right under whatever it is, Section 215 of the Patriot Act to do this. But beyond, if your point is that they didn't, that the information that they received doesn't go down to the individual level, that's not my understanding of this at all. The president said we weren't listening to your phone calls. That's what he contends. But frankly, the head of the NSA, at least in my estimation, lied to Congress about what they were doing or not doing quite recently. Or I guess he would say you didn't ask me the right question. So I don't get the sense, Brian, and your connection's bad, so I got to let you go. Thanks for the call. That this is not, I don't agree, this is not coming down to the individual level.
You know, Stephen, who's a lawyer, has a great point here. He asked about whether he should stay here. That would be Snowden. And Stephen's answer, but then he has to trust in the integrity of the criminal justice system run by the same government he doesn't trust on surveillance. It's an interesting point.
Well, it's moderately interesting. 877-301, Stephen, I love you, but 301-8970.
I think it's a brilliant point, Stephen.
It's a brilliant point. That's what I meant.
Tim in the car, what do you think about the Mr. Snowden, hero or traitor?
I think he's a hero. I really do think this is a, you know, clear violation of the Fourth Amendment and of the Constitution. You know, we're talking about property, and it's not just phone records, too. I think that's really important to point out that he, in the interview with The Guardian, he said that virtually anything on the web that you do goes into a database and that anyone of his security clearance level can access it at any time without any warrant or anything. And this, I think it's just outrageous. I mean, I'm really glad that he did it. You know, I hope he stays safe and that's kind of where I stand on it.
Thank you for the call, Tim. You know, one of the interesting counterarguments to that, though, and you've heard this from a lot of young people over the weekend commenting on story on the story, being interviewed about this story, that their expectation, maybe because their parents have told them this since they started posting stuff on, you know, MySpace back before they were all on Facebook, their expectation is that whatever they have online is open to the world and that this is the internet age. And
individual emails? I don't think people have that expectation.
Well,
the individual emails are going to be
discoverable. I think, you know, in any kind of court proceeding, your individual emails are there and to be called by the investigators if you are arrested for some dastardly crime.
If you're charged with something, that's the whole point. Why the caller just said this is arguably a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
But the
99.9% of the people whose information is being culled through
point is that I think there's a certain an expectation among people in their 20s and 30s that nothing is private that goes out online, even your emails.
There's a great piece in the Boston Herald where they quote Barack Obama at his press conference on Thursday, where he said, when it comes to telephone calls, this is a quote, every member of Congress has been briefed on this program. Well, the Herald then went out and interviewed two very liberal and one moderate to liberal Congress people from Massachusetts. Steve Lynch, that's not true. Mike Capuano calls it un-American. He found out about the NSA programs through media reports. And Jim McGovern from Worcester said he'd never heard of these either. Now, these are people who are traditionally strong supporters of the president.
Right.
These are not critics.
No.
All three of them say we didn't know anything about it, despite the fact that the president says, quote, every member of Congress has been briefed on this program. Let's take one or two more quick calls.
877-301-8970. Do we already go to Tim in the car? I think we already went to Tim
in
the car. Okay, let's go to John in Andover. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I think that one of the key parts about this is whether he's a hero or a villain really depends on whether you trust the process. The intelligence community uses a process called intelligence oversight in order to be able to determine whether data is or should be collected on U.S. persons or not. And it really should bring up an interesting discussion about whether or not that process is working. Is it functioning or is it not? And if it is, then really he should never have disclosed that information. If it's not, though, maybe we should have a little bit more insight into how those intelligence processes work. How are we setting up a system that even though we can't see the data, we can trust the people that are making the decision?
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not so sure it is. John, thank you for the call. Why? What's a good point?
What's your whole argument, by the way? Is he a hero or a traitor?
I don't know if he's a hero or a traitor. What I do know is that the notion that the United States government, to protect us from harm, has got to surveil all of the communications, written, telephonic, of everybody in the United States, including the vast majority of us who are suspected of nothing, is frightening to me. It is really Big Brother-esque. And if people say, well, it is helping to keep us safe, I guess that's the point, you know, if the people in charge are responsible people and we trust them, then based on that theory, then we should let them have everything. You know, I asked you about a camera in your house the other day and you mocked me. I had a better example this morning that I will steal from somebody
I
read.
I'm ready.
How about someone going into your mailbox? This is not going into the physical mailbox in your house and opening up every single item or reading it with some technologically advanced thing. Would you be okay with that?
No, outrageous.
And why is
horrible.
That? Why is that? You know why that's different? Because there's a perspective on cyber intrusion as opposed
to
physical.
I think there
is. Excuse me. Tell me what the difference is. When they get your emails under the prison program, how is that any different from them looking at your snail mail? There's no difference.
It's what you've been telling your kids forever. Don't put anything online you wouldn't want.
So that makes it okay.
Daddy and grandmother.
So that makes it okay because of what you've said to your children.
Okay, I'm saying it's. I think that people have a different perspective. It's
one different expectation. You're talking about.
Yes, you put these things out in cyberspace that everybody has access to, and they're not normally looking at it. But I mean, for heaven's sakes, how many people's email has been gone into when they're in some trouble? Not a crime, a situation at work that they're in trouble for. No crime. It's just
another difference there. I don't like it, but as you know, we've read a lot of those stories. A lot of those stories, when people start work in those kind of places, they are told that your email on the server, on the workplace's server, this is not like the Harvard situation where they were checking personal emails too. Your work email is your work email, and you should have no expectation of any privacy. We were not told by the federal government that we should have no expectation of privacy with our phone calls and our personal emails. We learned about it thanks to this Edward Snowden.
Well, I think people are much more upset about their phone calls and their personal stuff than their stuff online because, again, I think if you think you have a privacy online, you're crazy because you don't. Anyway, have you been a victim of an NSTAR blackout? Well, it's been a little over a year since the Big Back Bay blackout. NSTAR had an encore performance this weekend, which affected approximately 12,000 customers. So when the lights are on at NSTAR, is anybody home? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
WGBH's fiscal year now ends on June 30th. That means there's even less time to cover the costs of the programs you love. So, to encourage you to do your part, WGBH has teamed up with PBS travel guru Rick Steves.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves.
Make a gift in any amount and you'll be entered to win a trip for two to Europe.
But hurry, there isn't much time left to enter. The sweepstakes ends June 30th.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org. And Harvard Extension School, over 225 online courses from nutrition and health to presidential power in the U.S. Information session June 12th. More information available at extension.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yet another outage at NSTAR in Boston. This time, 12,000 customers. We'll define customer in a minute. 12,000 customers affected. Is this just something we have to learn to live with, or is the customer being abused? Joining us to share her thoughts, you heard her voice a minute ago, on the latest once-in-a-century outage is the host of Greater Boston. That would be Emily Rooney.
By the way, what? This is the third. Because I recall there was the one in March 2012, and then a few months later, May of 2012, the exact same footprint. And now this one is the third time. It's the exact same footprint every time. It doesn't really make you inspire a lot of confidence.
The Scotia, so is it pronounced Scotia?
Scotia Street
Substation.
Yeah. So what happened at the Scotia Street Substation, Emily, that affected you, I presume, and other 12,000
people? Yeah, I mean, this was not a catastrophe because, first of all, the weather was warm. It went off at 3:15 in the morning, and most everybody was back up by mid-morning. Like mine came on at 10:15, and it was a Sunday, so it wasn't, you know, a crisis. However, it made the city a disaster because they closed the Prue Tunnel. You know, traffic was gridlocked then, and it had been gridlocked all day the previous day because of the gay pride parade. And then I thought for sure they would cancel the AIDS walk or whatever it was yesterday. So, no, you had that on top of the closing of the tunnel and, you know, it's
well, let me ask a setup question
where
I know the answer, but I'll ask it very carefully. So, but let's face it, it was only 12,000 individuals who were affected by this,
gosh.
Emily Rooney.
This is so bogus, and all the media just eats this
they
up.
They do.
Even the front page of the Globe says 12,000. Well, did you know that the Copley Fairmount is one customer? How many people would you guess were at the Copley that?
Oh, maybe 1,000?
Maybe 2,000.
2,000,
yeah.
Okay.
That's one customer.
Neiman Marcus, one customer.
Yeah.
And all those people, I have a friend who works there. I mean, you know, you got to... They got to call everybody and tell them it's a new work schedule. It affects hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, I guess the thing is, what is going on? Every time we turn around, there seems to be another fire or some malfunction.
They claim that they were within 2 weeks of a completely new electrical system at the Scotia Street substation, and that something like a cable that connects to the transformer to the electric grid went. I mean, I know that doesn't mean anything to me. I don't know. But why is it the exact same footprint every time? And does this mean it's not going to happen again?
Yeah, by the way, no. I invited a spokesperson from NSTAR and they couldn't make it. But one of their spokespeople did text me the following. When up and running, it, meaning the substation, has redundant, meaning backup system. So if one transformer goes down, power stays on. Because only one transformer was running during the upgrade work, the other one had a cable failure and went down with no backup. Power goes up. Upgrade work was 1 week away from completion.
Yeah,
so I guess what she's saying is a week from now, we won't have to worry about this substation anymore. You buying it?
But no. I mean, and one of the things that I find really curious is why it's been the exact same footprint every time. Something. What is it? Well, if there, why wasn't it the other part of the city then? If this whole thing about the cable, there's something about this particular section. What is it?
You know what
they haven't explained it.
You know what the problem with this is? We're talking about the NSTAR outage in the Back Bay and whether or not this is just going to keep happening. You wrote about this a couple of years ago, Marjorie. The real issue here is not just the outage. The real issue is there's a monopoly utility in Boston.
Yes. We need to get that municipal thing going here.
Well, that's Marjorie's
like Hudson.
Oh, if people don't know this, I didn't know this until I did some research on it a while ago when we were always having these storm of the century outages over and over again in the same century, that there are these certain towns, Concord, Wellesley,
Hudson,
that have municipal lighting services. Their bills are lower. They have far fewer outages. Customers say that they're much better. The electric companies about trimming the trees.
And when they do have outages, they get back
online
much
more quickly.
And
you have that local person there that you can call and scream
at.
Isn't
there some bill going through?
Yes.
Jay Kaufman has filed legislation for municipal lighting a dozen times over maybe he's done it 10 years, but he's done it at least 10 times over the decade, and it gets nowhere.
Why
of
do we need the legislature's permission to have a municipal system?
That's a very good question, but we never get anywhere because, of course, the big electric companies, I'm sure they're very
generous.
Well,
how do some of these towns get around it? How does Hudson?
Because back in the 20s, it happened back in the 20s.
The most recent, if I remember your column, Marjorie, and I may be off by a decade,
1921.
The most recent municipal light company, for lack of a better expression, that's come into play was something like 70 or 80 years ago, because I believe, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong at 877-301-8970, the stated law is that the incumbent utility has the ability to charge exorbitant fees for their poles and wires and all that sort of stuff. So what I think Jay Kaufman's bill, this bill, he's a state rep in Lexington, does is sort of make this more affordable for a competitor. But the issue is this. Every time there's a major outage, and this isn't a huge one, even though you're right, it's not 12,000 customers.
No,
it's probably 100,000 people.
Thousand.
But the fact that there's not
maybe
a big push on Beacon Hill to take away monopoly status from any and all of these utilities is insane.
Yet again, this gets back to the fact that there's no term limit, so people keep demanding more and more money. They need help for their re-election campaign, and they're going to keep taking these money. And naturally, NSTAR has a lot more money to and ability to contribute to politicians than some little municipal muni company in Lexington.
You know, and I just want to keep saying this, that this is not, you know, an act of nature that caused this. This is something, an internal problem. And when you really look at it, you know, I admit I live in the Back Bay. I'm fine. I can walk up and down stairs. But it affects tens of thousands of people who can't, or they're up on the 30th floor of some hotel. All the restaurants go down. The businesses, if you heard that that there was a black, and you were planning to go into the city yesterday afternoon, you're probably, let's skip it.
So absolutely.
It has this profound rollover effect into all the businesses. You know, that one from March of 2012, they were offline for 4 days in some areas.
That's right. And all the waitresses and all the dishwashers and everybody else in the restaurants.
Also older people in high rises. Yeah. You heard these stories about people who have no electricity, have no refrigeration, even though a day you can probably last, can't walk up and down the whatever it is, the two dozen stairs or that sort of thing.
I did see Tom May, the $9 million man, as Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe always called him in his columns about him. I think he's more than $9 million man now.
Yeah, $30 million, isn't he?
Well, whatever he is. He's multimillionaire. I did see him out in the scene. He was looking very thin.
He looked like a thin guy.
He very, very thin. And he was a cap on his head. So he was on the scene talking to people about restoring power.
But then, in all fairness, an entity that is lucky enough to have a monopoly is never going to say, here, take this. We don't think this is fair. Let's have competition. This is where the legislature has got to come in and say, we're going to create a level playing field. So, you know, by the way, let's put it this way. Do you think there would – how many outages at this one substation? Three?
Three.
Is that what you said?
Three.
Do you think there would have been a second and third outage if there was a competitor where the people who were aggrieved by the first one said, I'm switching to John Doe utility? Of course not, because they knew they'd lose their customers. Since they have no threat of losing anything, there's no incentive to do the right thing.
There's no communication from MSTAR. I was expecting one of those reverse phone calls, something, anything, nothing. And there's never any attempt to make amends to anybody. I mean, I don't need amends, but, you know, maybe some of these businesses and stuff too. But, you know, there's nothing.
What I love is how, when your electricity was out for like 4 or 5 days, you get charged for your electricity even though it was out.
I mean, exactly.
Your air conditioning bill, you get charged for that even though you haven't been able to run it for, you know. Or when they were up in these terrible winter storms, remember that? When the people could not.
Of course we do.
Of course, they're having to run their generators and they're getting charged nonetheless.
Let's take one or two calls, see if we can work Emily into a frenzy before she leaves. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Somerville with Alma. Alma, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
Great.
Would like to remind folks that this is what happens when people say, oh, let's give private business. They're the answer to every problem we have, and they work so much better than government. Remember this, and also remember that the big difference to me between government and private business is that government has to be at least somewhat transparent, and private business can hide everything they want. So it's never quite as simple as let's give private business to fix all our problems because they'll take care of it.
Well, but to extend your thought, and if you are going to ask the private sector to do X, provide utility power services to everybody, then I don't want to be a broken record, then provide competition. So there's an incentive for them to do the best possible job at the cheapest possible rate. Alma, thanks so much for the call.
That's a good point, and the transparency is good because it really is one of those public-private situations. It's a public service, but they're given the contract to run it. I mean, it's a good point. They should be completely transparent. It shouldn't take Brian McGrory for us to know that Tom made $30 million in a year.
Brian, Marjorie mentioned this. When Brian McGrory, I don't know if he made $30
million.
When Brian McGrory was a columnist. Northeast Utilities took over, there was some bonus that was paid, whatever it was.
They're a public utility, are they not?
Well, let's just focus on this for 1 second, and then because I'm being
now
worked into a frenzy. You know, and this is, again, you get what you can get. I understand that. The notion that we have a system that allows somebody who runs a monopoly public utility to make millions and millions of dollars is just obscene.
Everybody has to have electricity. I feel that way about being
the
president
of a bank,
too.
And your customers can't go anywhere.
What are you going to do? Put your money under the mattress?
No, but there's a big
Why
difference.
Why do you need to make $30 million?
You're wrong about that. There's a big difference. Go 3 blocks from here. There's a bank on every single corner. If you don't like what one bank says, you go to the other one. If you don't like what they do, you go to the other one.
No, but you need to put your money in a bank is what I'm saying.
What?
I'm saying you need to put your money in a bank.
Yes, you do.
So how hard is it to run a bank?
Well, you have to treat people well or they're going to go elsewhere. Here, it doesn't matter how you treat people.
No, you know, Bank of America treats people terribly, and they have the monopoly on that, too.
Fine point. Let's take one more quick one. I'm wrong. Mike from North Attleboro. You're on with Emily Rooney, Marjorie Egan, and Jim Bradley. We're talking about the latest NSTAR outage in the Back Bay. Hey.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great, thanks.
Hey, listen, what this comes right down to is deregulation, period.
Yes.
We didn't have this type of problem when the government was, you know, more involved. These companies are not, they're not concerned about keeping the lights on. They're concerned about keeping the meters spinning.
That's right.
They shouldn't be for-profit, period. It's a basic, necessary infrastructure for business and people to, you know, to go about their lives.
Now, Mike, I have to interrupt you for just one second,
because
you probably did not realize that you were talking to Mr. Deregulation over here.
Mr. Anti-Deregulation. My late great friend, John O'Connor, and I led an effort to stop the deregulation of the public utilities for the same reason
on my
you
show
mentioned.
Every other day.
We were, by the way, we were outspent for whatever it's worth by a mere $8 million coming out of your ratepayers' pocket. $8 million to $300,000. And we lost, as you'd expect, if you're outspent 24-1. You were against me then, weren't you?
All you really need to do is, if you just go online and look at what the earnings have been, look for National Grid, look for NSTAR, look at what the earnings are for these companies. If the reason... The reason when there's a big storm and you have a problem, you can't get your lights on, is because 20 years ago, they would have the manpower ready to go.
That's right. You're so right. They have to bring them in from other states.
Now they have to stage up these contracts.
Yep.
They have to do all kinds of legwork to save a buck. Period. It's about money. It's about making money.
Mike, you said it well. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay, another disgrace.
Let's get one more in here. John, you're on 24 South. Quickly, John. You're
so
on with
many.
Emily Rooney.
It's hard to keep up.
Me, yeah. Marjorie, and me. Hey, John, go.
Hey, Jim. I heard you saying that NSTAR has no competition. Well, they do have competition from solar power. I sell solar power systems for my living.
It's a very good point.
One of the tools I use is we take a look at the electric bill, and the electric bill is obscene, and it's really easy to get people fired up about their bill. There is competition. People should look to go solar because you'd be a whole lot better off providing your own power.
John, thank you for putting the
cap on
the How much
is the cost to go solar, though? That's expensive. Original investment's
like $3,000.
Well, there's some taxpayer subsidies and that sort of thing.
That's not that bad.
Well, but somebody living in an apartment building, is that you can't put a solar panel on the roof of your apartment.
You can't?
Your
house,
apartment?
Not in the back bed. The roof of your house. Maybe the roof of your house.
We'll do some research on it. We'll get back to you tomorrow. Emily, thank you very much for stopping by.
Me too. I know.
But nothing will happen. You know, that's the other thing. And in part, it's our fault.
It is our fault.
We scream about this every single time, and we don't stay on it.
Municipal light companies, you know, it's not that sexy.
It's
sexy to me. It's really hard to get people excited
Emily
about
and I
that.
Are going to stay on it this time.
We're hammering this. We're hammering this one.
See you, Emily.
Okay. When we come back, the Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III joined us for open mic. We're going to talk to him about condoms in schools, the Trayvon Martin trial, and a bunch of other stuff. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH.
What are you willing to do to give your children the best shot at success?
From July until mid-August, we will probably have stayed in 4 or 5 hotels and traveled over 2,000 miles.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Next time on Marketplace, our series Consumed, Why We Buy and Where It Gets Us. It's from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Butler Hospital conducting a research study for depression requiring daily visits for 6 weeks involving a new form of brain stimulation. Information at 401-455-6537 or newdepressionstudy.com. And Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick or at doverrug.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And our time is a little bit off today, but we sort of know where we are. Joining us about 20 minutes late, our fault, not his, on open mic as he does every Monday. I'd say at 1 o'clock, but it's now 1:21, is Eugene F. Rivers III. He's a co-founder of Boston's 10-Point Coalition. Reverend Rivers, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, good people.
So good to see you, Reverend Rivers, too. So we've been talking before you got here about, and what we talked about last week as well, about President Obama going after everybody's records, phone records, et cetera, online that I was sort of stunned by. And you claim you're not stunned at all.
President Obama, I expected, and I said this on MSNBC and a couple other places, as the first black president, was probably going to govern center-right. And my argument was that being the first black dude in the White House, he was going to have to be tough on crime, and he had to go hard right on everything just to survive. So my view was, number one, people have an exaggerated expectations of the executive branch of office. That's number one. Number two, he sold the world everything because that was just part of the boilerplate and the airbrush of being the first black guy. So this over-airbrush guy who promised everything to everybody forever, right? couldn't deliver.
But wait a second. If I had said to you, how long has he been there? 5 years now? 5 years.
Yeah.
If I had said to you 5.5 years ago, when it was pretty clear he was beating John McCain,
yes.
In 5.5 years, we're going to learn that the transparent Barack Obama, who sponsored an amendment to eliminate this provision of the Patriot Act, that is the one in question, I think it's Section 215, is going to be leading arguably the most massive surveillance of his own citizens in American history, or at least comparable to the most massive, you would have said that's going to happen?
Absolutely.
Because he's got to be something he's not. So, is that what it is?
No. What he has to, as the first black president, for him to survive, he would have to go hard right so that he was not soft on crime.
But he has survived. He's just been reelected for a second term. So why can't he come out of the closet now in the last 2 years of his presidency?
A couple of things. One, that's not going to happen because in a very interesting way, in addition to sort of the existential political logic of being the first black male, and the liberal media has missed this completely, he's a conservative incrementalist. He's a moderate Republican. He's always been a moderate Republican. Now,
well, I think you could say he's a moderate. I don't know where the Republican comes from. He's a moderate to liberal leaning guy.
I'll tell you what I mean by moderate.
When he was young.
Let me explain what I mean. I don't mean that his party affiliation is Republican. What I'm saying is that if we look at someone who personally supervised the assassinations of people around the world, right? Guantanamo.
We're talking about the drone strikes.
And then the authorization of the domestic use of drones. Had Richard Nixon authorized the domestic use of what would then be drones?
He would have been impeached twice.
He would have been impeached five times.
Yeah.
You understand? So what I'm saying is that when you think about it, right, or that when you look at the actual domestic policies of Richard Nixon, which no one paid attention to because we were having too much fun with the impeachment deal, right? On domestic policy, he's the right of Nixon. Now, part of that's because he's broke.
By the way, I was a young legal services lawyer. You know who created the legal services institution, civil legal assistance for poor people, under Richard Nixon? Yeah, it was. Created that.
So what's fascinating, because people have no memory, is that if we actually drill down into Richard Nixon and look at the stuff that he's done, the thing that was a source of endless amusement for me is that, one, I had no expectations. Two, I'm not disappointed. Three, all the stuff that he's doing now is completely consistent to me.
But again, he can be a little bit more daring and be who he is when you only have 2 years left in your presidency.
Can I play Gene Rivers
here? The legacy issue.
Here's what I would argue.
The legacy is he's black.
See, but
that's the extent of his
no,
legacy.
I think that is so far from true.
Okay,
people were trying to get.
Healthcare, I give you that.
70 years, people were trying to get. Okay, fine.
I give you healthcare.
And he probably is going to get immigration reform.
Some version of it.
Okay, and gay marriage is expanding, et cetera. Even though I know you have an issue with that.
Okay, but that's okay.
But, you know, the Rivers argument, which 3 minutes ago I rejected, one might argue he's not doing whatever he's doing because of the public. He may be doing what he's doing to ensure people in his military infrastructure that he's not a softy, that he's not a lefty on these sort of issues.
Absolutely.
And so that's the audience he's trying to convince.
He's got to play to his right not to lose them because he's trying to maintain the center. So if I'm trying to maintain the center so I can get some compromises, I'm giving a whole bunch to the right because the presumption is those are the people I have to win. That makes complete sense to me logically.
Okay.
He's got to tack to the center.
Now, right? Speaking of the right, Gene Rivers, one of the things we wanted to ask you about as a Bostonian, as a co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition, there was a story in the Globe on Saturday. The Boston School Committee is considering a policy change that would make condoms available to high school students across the city to prevent teenage pregnancy and the spread of sexually transmitted infections. You know, they've been available since sometime in the 90s, depending on whether or not there was a healthcare professional or something like that in the schools. Now they're talking about broadening that far wider. Are you okay with that?
Yes, because it's well-intentioned and probably won't work. But on principle, I'll support it because I don't want to hear anything from goofy liberals.
Well, putting aside the goofy liberal thing, how about the whole notion that nobody testified against this, which I thought was quite surprising. Student after student testified in there and basically said, They also urge the school committee, again, I'm reading from the Globe, to make sure all high schools follow through on a current requirement of providing comprehensive sexual health education, which apparently is not happening in a lot of schools. So if it turns out that happens, and at the same time, once that's the – that has to happen before a condom is handed to a kid.
Well, see,
isn't that the right course here?
I think on paper that's correct. I don't know what these people mean by comprehensive sex education. I mean, I think that means do everything safely.
Well, right? That is what it means. Yeah. That is exactly what it means.
Do everything safely. Now, that's not comprehensive sex education to me, but I don't want to get into that discussion. All right, so let them do anything, but make sure you do it safe. That's I think, dysfunctional, personally. On the condom piece, I am perfectly willing. I worked on a lot of AIDS Africa stuff. In the beginning with Bono, and in fact, I actually worked with Samantha Power at the time.
Who is
and
about
Jeffrey
to
Sachs.
Be the, well, maybe the
right.
Secretary of the United
Nations.
And
you know, went to Africa, and the bright liberal idea was pass out condoms to everybody, right? The problem was when you got to Uganda, Nairobi, nobody used them. Nobody used them.
Well, see,
they passed them out to everybody, but nobody used them. And no one was willing to have the adult conversations about what the implications were or why we dumped a million condoms on the continent of Africa and nobody used them.
But see, one of the things I think is attractive about this program is someone said it's not about just putting condoms in a bunch of bowls and you can come in and grab them if you want and leave. There's about counseling on safe sex. And one of the things I think is very useful for girls is to come up with all the reasons that when the boy says, oh, no, we don't want one, or oh, no, we don't need one, or oh, no, I'll do this, that, and the other thing, that she is armed with good arguments, because I think that's where the rubber meets the road, no pun intended. You know
but
what I mean?
Beautifully done. Anyway.
I mean, boys don't want them, and you have to be able to talk. A young woman has to be able to convince her boyfriend.
Do you think your fellow ministers would agree with you on this thing?
Probably not.
I know you haven't done a survey.
But let's go back to the boys don't want them. Let me throw you a curveball that's going to hurt your brain. So I want you to grab your head.
Okay.
This is
going
to fall off your neck in a minute. Right.
Okay.
There are a lot of girls that don't want them.
They want the babies.
Well, no. This is intelligent talk radio, right? I'll simply put it to you this way. There are girls who don't want the interference.
Wow. Okay.
No, and I know this from in discussions. Uh-huh. We've had the conversations about what we call, with the two fingers, safe sex.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, condoms, all right? So you don't believe in abstinence. I got it, all right? And that's not an appropriate thing to say in this part of America, right? So let's do condoms. No. And this is amazing. I mean, my head just about dropped off my neck as I had young women who under normal circumstances would be intelligent women saying, no, he doesn't want it. I don't want it.
But don't you think that's in part a cover for what you rejected that Marjorie just said? We learned about after the Gloucester situation a couple of years ago. What we learned is people went further and further into the story was a lot of these young women actually wanted to get pregnant. There was a feeling that would create a sense of self-worth.
Because the stigma is gone, and I don't want to bring back the stigma necessarily.
No, actually,
we need a halfway.
It's interesting. And you make a very powerful point about that. Look, the baby thing meets a whole bunch of existential, psychological, and cultural needs that aren't being satisfied in healthy ways. So, in fact, I preached about this yesterday, right? So I'm a young girl. I look for love in all the wrong places. And many of the girls, the good girls like bad boys, are on what I call a save-a-fool mission, where some fool who is an absolute moron, she thinks is cute, and she wants to have that fool's baby. So part of the mission is, yo, baby, you know, I got to have that special feeling. I don't want to use the protection. Well, baby, I love you. And maybe if I, right? So there is this difficulty for especially these little adolescent girls where there's no father. And let me say something about this father thing, because I know this is not father country. One of the things that I've learned from the girls, you've got a generation of young girls who've never known the love of a father, because the dad at his best is the first boyfriend who introduces the daughter to her sense of her sexuality without abuse in a safe space. Now, deprived of that, she doesn't know how to properly appreciate herself, and as a result, can get pulled because of the needs to have attention, to have love and affirmation, and then some idiot, some fool abuses a child as a teenager. So I agree. The pregnancy piece is very deep, psychologically and emotionally. And then the girl discovers that when the fool is gone before the baby's born, that she's stuck. No, it's very tough.
You know, Reverend Rivers, to add to the list of what you say are the lack of accomplishments of the President of the United States, he's given some of the finest speeches I've ever heard on the importance of the fathers of babies being fathers, not just when they impregnate a young woman, but when there is an actual baby and then a kid. Would you not agree with that?
In fact, I'd say one of the most significant things he's done for the black community, frankly, has been, I was thinking about this, I'm writing something on him, right? It's his fatherhood stuff. And what he said in code is, black people, this office is limited. You people need to organize and do for yourselves. When he went to the Black Congressional Caucus thing, he said, stop whining, folks, get a grip. And so his emphasis on self-reliance is one of the smartest things. And he's actually performed a service for the black community because, look, he's saying, you know what? No more government cheese, y'all. You people, we have too many resources at our disposal that we're wasting. So, no.
But the white community, the unwed birth thing is huge now, too. I mean, it didn't used to be.
But that's not black people's problem.
No, it's not. But it is right across the board. I mean, I wish people would get married. Is Angelina Jolie going to get married anytime soon?
I haven't spoken to her in weeks, so I really wouldn't know.
Can they please get married? I know she went through this recent tragedy.
I'm glad you said it, not me.
Well, yeah. I want her to get married. She got six kids.
Okay,
I mean,
speaking of your writings, Reverend Rivers, a year ago, I pulled this out today because obviously today is the first day of the trial. Well, when I say obviously, virtually no one's paying attention, at least like they were a year ago. George Zimmerman is on trial for the shooting and killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida. Here's a line from your op-ed in the Boston Globe of April 28th of last year. I'm sure you remember the line. If George Zimmerman were black, it is unlikely we would even know the name Trayvon Martin. What was your point?
My point was that if George Zimmerman were black, the fact is, as I argued, we wouldn't be talking about this. There would not be people, you know, symbolically purchasing Skittles and wearing hoods on the floor of the House as Congressman Bobby Rush did. We wouldn't have had this absolutely ludicrous theater where people were getting on jets to get to Florida so they could march around and be professional victims. No, the backstory is that there is a larger issue. George Zimmerman is only important because, to a great extent, and I said this in the article, right? There's a professional victim deal that the black community engages in, which assists them in not addressing the real problem. Because think about this. Let's talk about this next week. How many black males have been killed since Trayvon Martin died?
Thousands.
Thousands, right? And you know that the vast majority of them had to be black because nobody's marching.
Listen to this, by the way. In this piece that Reverend Rivers wrote for the Boston Globe, if George Zimmerman were black, listen to some of these statistics. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, 2007, blacks, who were only 12% of the population, accounted for 49% of all homicide victims in 2005. Listen to this. Just listen. Blacks commit 93% of the murders of other blacks. And why is that? Because that's the infamous dog tail wagging the dog, or vice versa, that we don't talk about. Why don't we talk about that at all?
That is the problem. We don't talk about it. And I say this in the article. In the last paragraph, I say, listen, we don't talk about these issues nationally because black leadership, and I've just sort of figured this out. I've been really putting my brain on this. Black leadership feel too insecure, one, because they're always worried about what white people think. I mean, this is just crazy. So we fall back on this literally professional victim thing. We're insecure. I'm talking about as a class. The elites, the people that should be shaping opinion on this issue, feel insecure, and we lack sophistication. 2 points. So that, listen, we should be leading the conversation. I say in the article. Excuse me.
Yeah, take it.
Thank you
He's
going to
quote himself.
Page three. Last paragraph's on page three.
Right.
Go ahead. Now I want to make a point.
If Zimmerman were black, the challenge before black leadership would be how to deal with the pain, fear, humiliation, incomprehension, and sense of powerlessness that are bound up in the condition of poor black men in today's society. And until black leadership and the black community confront these facts, we cannot expect others to be genuinely concerned, or committed to addressing the horrible tragedy that overwhelms the lives of countless black males.
But you know what I would like to talk about with you, and we don't have time today, but maybe next week. My theory is one of the problems for inner city black communities is how can you get anywhere when you can't get an education anymore in 90% of the schools in inner city America. I mean, Boston does better than most because we're a small town. But, I mean, I've argued this about this with Jim. I mean, it's clear the schools are failing in inner cities, and the Democrats have supported the schools as is. And
supported the unions.
They've supported the unions, exactly. And the unions do not want to get real reform. So, I mean, if you are a young black male right now or a young black female in Philadelphia or in Washington, you're trapped. Or Baltimore.
Well, absolutely. By the way, while the two of you were in this love fest about this, we can have a much longer debate about whether the unions want reform. Reform to many people, and I think, Marjorie, you occasionally fall in this category, is capitulation on a whole host of issues.
Absolutely.
The unions aren't willing to do that. Well, you just agreed with both of us, Gene. What are you doing here? Which side are you
on? What is this?
Capitulation on what? On a longer school day?
Well, no. And as I've said to you repeatedly,
well, that's my point, that they will not – listen – we need longer days.
Longer days.
Longer days and, look,
better
6
teachers.
Days. Better teachers and,
should
listen,
they be paid for it?
What's that now?
Should they be paid for,
yes,
longer
they
days?
They should be merit pay.
Right. They should be merit pay.
And you're against that.
Because a longer day with an inferior teacher is not progress.
Exactly.
I think we can agree on that.
Okay. One last thing. Jim and Callie Crossley, our colleague here at WGBH, really get into fisticuffs.
We didn't get into fisticuffs.
Yes, you did. I thought
there
was going to be blows. It was outrageous. We were talking last week about Michelle Obama was heckled by a woman that was
a wingnut. A fundraiser, a lesbian activist in Washington.
Right. And Callie thought that there might have been some undertone of racism here when this woman talked about, the gay woman talked about Michelle Obama's big hand on her after this incident where Obama went up to the heckler and said, you know, either you stop talking or I'm leaving, kind of thing. What do you think? I mean, Jim argued with Callie.
I followed the thing. And actually, I'll tell you what I did. Late last night, there's a black barbershop that I don't know why. They're open until like 10 o'clock at night. And I had to get my walk because I'm trying to get my weight down, right? So I went to my black
barbershop.
I see
your Adidas outfit.
Yeah. So I go to the black barbershop. These are all my wise guys, right, to sort of keep me. So I said, hey, fellas, I want to talk about it. Did y'all hear about the thing with Michelle Obama and a woman that went and hollered and at some fundraiser? Mm-hmm. And so they all fell out laughing, right? So I said, what y'all think about that, man? This late last night, right? They said, look, well, Rivers, let me tell you. Number one, I was worried about the girl that hollered at Michelle. He says, Michelle's a tough something, Tom. She said, and it was so funny, right? They said, listen, let me tell you something. And it was amazing how these guys, they were so perceptive. They said, and they say, frankly, what was most amusing and interesting was not the girl that hollered, but Michelle's response. Michelle said, if we could put subtitles under the television, right, and we could translate this into Southside Chicago black, what Michelle said to that girl was, baby, I'm not the one. You got this confused with my husband. Honey, I'm not having it, honey. Do you see these guns here, girl? Honey, you in trouble. Lucky the cameras are... No, it was fascinating, right? And there was no racial thing. Listen, she was a gay activist to do what gay activists do. And here we go. If had it been Laura Bush, she would have done the same thing. Had it been Nancy Reagan, she would have done the same thing.
Gene Rivers and I are one. This is a rare moment.
No, let's leave it right there. There was nothing racial. She's up there. And the thing that's funny is that the woman, when she broke bad to go at Michelle, didn't understand. No, Michelle is Michelle Robinson from the South Side of Chicago by way of South Carolina. She's not Obama. Obama got the Honolulu thing. That's why you can holler at him and he ain't going to say nothing. Michelle's not having it. I love Michelle. I voted for Michelle. That's who I voted for.
Reverend Rivers, it's a pleasure. We'll see you next Monday. Hopefully closer to one next week.
Michelle
Thanks.
For president. Gotcha. All right.
The Reverend Eugene Withers is with us every Monday, supposedly closer to 1 o'clock. It was Jim's fault that he was late. Anyway, up next, we're going to talk about the Tony Awards last night with Jared Bowen. We're dying to know what you thought. We're going to tell you the best sound, best plays, how everything went down. We're also going to play some of the opening, which was spectacular. Jared Bowen on the Tony Awards up next.
R&B music sensation Chrisette Michelle is back with a fourth album, a little more upbeat than the earlier ones. Michelle says changing her diet gave her a different perspective.
I found out that there was this great connection between food and the soul. I didn't know if that made sense. I didn't care because it was true for me.
We hear about her new album and outlook next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and New England College of Business and Finance. NECB offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu. And Putnam Investments, recognizing that rising rates could be harmful to long-duration income strategies. You can find new drivers of return. This is Putnam Today, on the web at putnam.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Broadway's Tony Awards were handed out last night. I think you could say, at least my analysis, a bad night for Tom Hanks, but a great one for women, for African Americans, for Cambridge, for Mike Tyson, and of course, Doogie Howser, M.D. Neil Patrick Harris was the host. Listen to him in the opening act.
At the end of the day, we are gathered together to honor the best and the brightest. And tomorrow, the fashion police will report on your dress and who wore it the tightest. If you win, have the time of your life. Tell your manager, dad, and your mom thanks. Hi to your kids and your husband or wife, maybe just for the hell of it, Tom Hanks. Nothing is bigger and better than seeing a veteran get an ovation or seeing a brilliant beginner freak out on a win on their first nomination. There's a kid in the middle of nowhere who's sitting there living for Tony performances, singing and flipping along with the Pippins and Wickets and Kinkies, Matildas, and Mormonses. So we might reassure that kid and do something to spur that kid, because I promise you, all of us up here tonight, we were that kid, and now we're bigger. Tonight it's bigger.
He was totally brilliant. Neil Patrick Harris. If you missed last night's Tony Awards, arts reporter from GBH, Jared Boner, joins us in Studio 3 for a recap. Hey, Jared.
Hi, Jim. Marjorie.
That opening deal.
It was great, wasn't it?
Brilliant.
He was phenomenal. And don't you love that message? First of all, this is what he did there in Radio City Music Hall, which is this enormous space. But they brought basically all of New York theater. You had every essence of New York theater and Broadway shows and the dreams of people. You had it all there on stage, literally, with people from every show. And I love that message that he worked in with you. We have the kids out there who you know are watching this show. And this is what they want to be. They want to get to New York. And they might not even be able to talk about it yet. They may, in their families, they can't necessarily come out about wanting to be an actor, or if they're gay, they can't, have that conversation with their father or the mother. And he made it okay for so many people. And I just thought it was such a warm message. And he is so entertaining and so funny. I just love the opening number.
You know, yeah. Can I make an analogy, which is, I'll admit in advance is ridiculous, but I'll make it anyway. Whenever I can't stand hockey. When the Stanley Cup playoffs are on, everybody who loves hockey says, Jim, if you just watch the playoffs, you're going to be a hockey fan forever. If you've never been to a Broadway play or you've been to very few, if you just watched even the first 8 minutes, forget the whole show last night. You'd be rushing down. I'm serious. Yeah. You'd be willing to spend $300 a ticket. It was brilliant. I mean, virtually all of Broadway was in that opening bit.
I hope so, because there's something for everybody. There's little orphan Annie who would not appeal to a lot of people, I would suspect. I'm looking at you, Jim. I don't know how you feel about little Annie. And then you have Spider-Man, which appeals to a whole other generation of teenage kids who realize that maybe, yes, you too is doing the music, and this looks pretty cool, and the effects are great. And yeah, you have Doogie Howser, Neil Patrick Harris out there climbing the stage at the end of it. This is what I love about the Tonys, that is better than even the Grammys, the Oscars, the Emmys. I think the theater community, first of all, they know how to present. They know how to entertain. They know how to sing and engage an audience.
Great show.
But they don't take themselves so seriously that they can sort of have slip-ups. I mean, you had Neil Patrick Harris giggling a little bit when he was doing those mashup of titles of shows.
Yep.
And, they don't take themselves so seriously that there doesn't have to be that degree of polish, which I think sinks so many shows that just become so tedious and boring in the end.
Compared to, I was driving last night, so I didn't get to see the Tonys last night, but over the years, compared to the Oscars, they're much less boring. They're much less plotting. I mean, they're much more fun, and people give much better little acceptance speeches too. They're not nearly so, nobody's giving you a big speech about sending money off to some factory in some place or other.
Speaking of speeches, I'm a Cambridge kid. Diane Paulus obviously won last night. Let's hear a second or two of what Diane Paulus had to say.
To the American Repertory Theater at Harvard University, where Pippin was created, to my visionary board, my tireless staff led by Diane Borger, to the incredible Boston audiences that embraced this production when we first started, and to the Harvard president, Drew Faust, who says creativity is a form of knowledge.
Big night, not just for her, but for women in general, right?
Huge night for women. To have Diane Paulus win and then to have the best director for a play be a woman right afterward. But for Diane Paulus, this is huge. I mean, she's having a legendary career at this point. I mean, her last... Everything she's directed and brought to Broadway has won Best Revival of a Musical.
And she started Pippin, which won 4 awards last night. That started in Cambridge,
That started right,
right
here in Cambridge. Yep. I mean, but before that, she had done Hair, got that to Broadway. That started the Public Theater in New York, got that to Broadway. It won Best Revival of a Musical. Porgy and Bess, same thing, started right here in Boston at the ART, or Cambridge, I should say. Went to Broadway and won last year. And now she's done the same exact thing with Pippin. She's just a force to be reckoned with at this point because she has such amazing talent. And going back to my earlier point, she is somebody who grew up with musical theater, watched all of these shows, listened to these cast albums, just like Cyndi Lauper said last night, over and over and over again.
Too.
It courses through her blood. Absolutely.
No, I thought Cyndi Lauper was practically dead, by the way. Well, no, I'm serious. I had no idea.
She won for Pippin. She won for Pippin or Kinky Boots?
Cyndi Lauper won for Kinky Boots.
Kinky Boots, okay. And that's the one that won the 6 awards. That really was the big play of the night, Kinky
right,
Boots.
Right. I mean, everybody was talking about Matilda, of course, based on the Roald Dahl musical.
I love that movie. I never saw the play.
I saw the musical. I didn't like it. It was dark. I was actually, I have a sort of a darker sense of humor, but I was sort of disturbed by this. The moment they started twirling a child around by her braids up in the balcony and hurling her onto the stage, I thought, even for me, this is a little bit much. So I was happy to see.
They took that from Game of Thrones, by the way. That's really... Wait a second. So Kinky Boots, for those who haven't seen it, what is it, about a drag queen who does what?
It's actually about a factory who is running into financial dire straits. I haven't seen it, but it's running into financial dire straits, and so they decide rather than manufacture traditional shoes, they're going to start manufacturing kinky boots and for drag queens, gender illusionists, however you want to refer to them. And that's where it sort of takes off. But yeah, you have Harvey Fierstein behind it and Cyndi Lauper. And she didn't look dead, by the way. She looked great.
I had no idea what she had done. I mean, everybody knows her from her 2 classics, which were done, 30 years ago? It had to be, right? I mean, her 2 hit songs were 4 decades ago. Also, on the African, I read this. This is in the New York Times. At a time when only 15-20% of actors on Broadway are black, half of the major acting awards went to African Americans. And the top of the list, obviously, is the great Cicely Tyson, who is 88 years old.
Well, no, that was a misnomer. Oh. I think they couldn't add in the New York Times because I had to look that up myself. She's going to turn 80 this year. I mean, it's not a big difference.
Still, she's kid. Okay.
Absolutely. No, this was phenomenal. And I think you couldn't help but notice. You didn't even have to wait for the Times reported the next day. It just felt great. And this is, again, something you don't see in television and motion pictures. You don't see African-American actors winning like this because, first of all, they don't get cast like this. But yeah, all of the major roles. How great was that? And because they were all so deserving, especially Bettina Miller, who played leading player in Pippin, who is just, she's so forceful and she's nothing but captivating. And
so a person's listening to this or watched last night and says, yeah, I'm getting excited about this. But in light of the fact that I can't get a second mortgage, I can't anything.
I saw Lucky Guy, and I just bought tickets for the Book of Mormon.
How much were the tickets for either or both?
Oh, they're like $150. I mean, they're very, very expensive.
Which is not even the highest end, is
no,
it?
No, it's not the highest
so
end.
So what does one
but
do?
But you know what? Having said that, and I went and saw the play about Vince Lombardi, too, a couple of years ago, and those were also very expensive. You just go, and it is a phenomenal experience. I mean, you feel as though I got my money's worth, even though you're talking like $300 to go see one of these plays, not to mention that they're in New York. I mean, even in Boston, they're pretty expensive. You know, the Huntington Theater, which just got this big award. I went and saw Invisible Man at the Huntington Theater. Tell people about the Huntington Theater, their big award last night.
Well, they won the 2013 Tony for Regional Theater. They select one theater out of the entire United States every single year to receive an award. And this year, it was the Huntington Theater Company, which is just great. Because they're also doing fantastic work. And I think the Tony Committee really recognized the fact that they're also diving into the community here. And they have a playwriting fellowship. And so they bring in local writers like Ryan Landry, who we often talk about. And they work with him and they mentor him and they cultivate him. And then if he's lucky, which he was this year, he makes it into the season. So it's not like they're just plucking plays out of Arthur Miller or, old chestnuts. They're giving people a great opportunity. And Lydia Diamond, who's a fantastic local playwright, she wrote Stickfly about an African-American family one summer on Martha's Vineyard, which is a hilarious but also very searing play. They gave her this playwriting fellowship and made it into the season and made its way to Broadway. So I think they looked at examples like that, and that's why they cited the Huntington. But Jim, to get back to your point, I can tell you, I mean, one of the things you can do is you can see the shows here first at a fraction of the price. I mean, how fantastic is it that you can see Porgy and Bess here before it goes? You can go down to New York and say, oh, I saw that a year ago. You can see Pippin here. Huntington Theater Company is doing Jungle Book.
Yep.
That's how they're opening their fall season. That is probably Broadway bound because it is they're working with the Disney team, and it's I suspect it's going to be a spectacular production. But there are also a host of websites you can go on and get discount tickets. You can also do the TKTS booth in Times Square, which does benefit
that's
the
a day of deal. Is that
that's
not
a day of theater? Yeah. Yep. But I think you can go online and stuff now too. No, it is outrageously expensive, and in part because it's priced for business people and corporate expense accounts to take somebody to Book of Mormon.
Let's play. You know. We should do. We have some sound from some of the winners last night, just to give you a feel. Here's the opening number. It's called "Magic to Do" from Diane Polis' direction of Pippin. We'll listen to a little bit of it. I would just like to say, in terms of seeing things locally, Marjorie knows this. Jared does not do this, but Jared, you're going to be so jealous. You're going to pass out. When I was a kid, my mother used to take me to most of the musicals that came through Philly. Philly and New Haven were the primary places through which most Broadway. I saw an unknown 16-year-old in Funny Girl in Philadelphia, who, as most people know, became Barbra Streisand. Yeah. What was the play that when Sammy Davis Jr. went to Broadway? Was it Golden Boy or Golden something? I saw him. I mean, the opportunity locally to see these huge stars, or at least these great productions of these plays here, or maybe in New Haven, or it is the only way you can do it, and it's huge fun.
We have so many people that come through here. I was watching last night. I was thinking half the people on stage I've interviewed at some point because they've come through here to do Boston theater. You know, Audra McDonald, of course, just doing Porgy and Bess. We have all of these stars come here, and that's the great thing. It's so fun to go through your playbills after, and oh my God, I saw this person before. Now she's a huge star, like Jane Krakowski. I remember seeing her at one point, and now, of course, she's huge on 30 Rock and all those other shows.
So Broadway is very much alive and well. We're not worried about Broadway going down the tubes or anything.
I think that they had a little bit of a tough year. I mean, every year is different. It depends on, you know, who they can get. First of all, last year, everybody was decrying the fact that it was such a celebrity-filled culture that all you couldn't have a show on Broadway without putting in a Scarlett Johansson or Tom Hanks, and that this was the death knell of Broadway. Nobody was really going to get a big chance if you were a no-name person, and I think that's already switching back, especially while I like Tom Hanks a lot, I kind of appreciate the fact that they said, well, you can come and play in our sandbox, but we're not going to give you the prize. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was funny. I went to see Lucky Guy, and I think I was the youngest person in there by about like 30 years. Everybody was really old, and I wonder if that was because of Mike McAllary that the piece was about, who was a columnist, the New York Daily News, if they had to remember him from way back 20 years ago or something.
Well, I think, sadly, that is the larger theater audience, too. They're spending down their kids' inheritance by paying $500,000 on Broadway shows.
Is that right?
You said a minute ago, $300. It's $1,000. You take a kid, you take two kids.
You should drive down
back. You got to park. They want to go eat. I mean, it's $1,000. You know, the one thing we've left out from
Can't
the opening
let them eat,
I did
Jim. Popcorn.
Is if people are saying, why did Jim mention Mike Tyson? Mike Tyson, the former heavyweight champion of the world, was a major piece. He did a one-man show,
he
right?
He did a very, very limited run. It might have even been one performance, on Broadway.
And then the opening bit has him up with Neil Patrick Harris, who I didn't know he was as talented as he is. He is brilliant. Harris, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And Tyson is dancing with him. I mean,
it was sort of.
Well, you're right.
He was moving his legs, maybe, to the music.
For the heavyweight champion of the world, I thought he was totally uncoordinated as a dancer.
Great.
He was like hopping about. It was weird.
But how great is Broadway? They say, we don't care that you're Mike Tyson. We don't care that we don't understand anything that you're about, most likely. But come on our stage. We love you. We love that you're doing this.
Well, it's also clear, as you said before, how much he has to love Broadway to be willing to make fun of himself. I mean, most men in those sort of, I don't mean in his one-man show, but last night you were right. He looked foolish on the stage.
He did.
But he had to know he looked foolish, and he was part of it. And by the way, the thing we're talking about, the opening bit, which is roughly 8 minutes long, if you go on YouTube and just type in Neil Patrick Harris and opening and Tony's, you can see it. It's just, last question about him. He is so much better than most of the people who have hosted the Oscars in recent years, with a couple of wonderful exceptions. Is that world even possibly accessible to him, or is he considered now just a Broadway kind of guy?
No, because he's already said he's going to emcee the Emmys this year.
He is,
yeah. I put him in the same category as Hugh Jackman. They are just people who understand audience engagement. They're like the old school entertainers.
Yeah.
You know, they're people like Bette Midler, who actually was shunned. She should have been up there last night because She was great in her one woman show, I'll Eat You Last. But they're entertainers she plays Sue Menger's, a 70s Hollywood agent.
That's great.
It is hilarious. If you guys haven't seen it, you have to go down. You will nonstop laughing from beginning to end. But
when I was
like
in law school in New York City, I used to walk by a place called The Bagel on West 4th Street. And who would always be eating alone at the one table outside?
Not Bette Midler.
Bette Midler, yeah. It was unbelievable. In any case, Jared, that's great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. And thanks to you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can follow all of us on Twitter at BOS, as in Boston, BOS Public Radio. Follow me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Eakin. And we're on the web 24/7, obviously, at wgbhnews.org/BPR. Again, thanks so much for listening. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Eakin.
We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.